What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, you and I love to explore the world and outer space, and we've gone to Mars on this podcast. And now we're going to take a trip up to the brave new Arctic. Have you ever thought about going to one of the poles or extremes?
Actually, we went up to the Arctic.
We did?
Went up to the Arctic Circle. Yeah, we went up all the way up to Prudhoe Bay.
Now, what's it like up there?
There was a lot of ice, and the water was very cold.
Oh, so you could get cold water if you needed it.
Cold water.
Oh, that's nice. No, but seriously, I mean, is it as barren and desolate as we imagine? Or?
You know, when we went up during the summer,
there
was a lot of animals. We took a bus trip.
A bus trip?
We took a bus trip.
From where?
From Fairbanks.
Oh, okay. So you can take a bus from Alaska.
There's the, what's the name of that highway up there?
The Donner Pass, where everybody's eating each other?
Where the ice road truckers go.
I must have missed that reality show. So did you enjoy it? How long did you stay there?
It was
there?
Very interesting. We stayed up in Prudhoe Bay for 2 days. We slept in the same place as all the oil people stay up there. And they had great food. I tell you, the food was great. And the accommodations
A lot
were
of restaurants?
Good.
Yeah. And...
Well, no, they have these big buildings full of
food
and people.
Okay, but not restaurants. Well, we're going to go to the brave new Arctic, but we're not going to spend any time or have any meals. What we're going to be talking about is really what kind of telltale signs do we see in the Arctic that tell us about what's happening with our climate. Mark Serez, the author of Brave New Arctic, and he's also the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center and a professor of geography. I didn't know we had a National Snow and Ice Data Center, did you?
That makes two of us, no.
But a fascinating guy, and what I really liked about him, John, is that he was a bit of a skeptic about man's impact on climate, and he's come around after a long bit of research and thinking, and he admits that, look, nothing is infallible in terms of information, but he took his time to be convinced and used the Arctic as really an example of where the climate is changing more rapidly than in other places, and he is now convinced that we are having this deleterious impact that we all regret.
Well, I think it is happening, and there was talk about that when we were up there about some of the winters aren't as long as they were, so the freeze over for getting oil is getting tougher on some years. So now how it relates to the pollution and everything, that part I haven't figured out yet.
Well, he's saying that they are raising, what they see in the Arctic is raising this red flag, and that the region is warming twice as fast as the globe as a whole, and that the Arctic Ocean is quickly losing its summer sea ice cover. There are just a lot of things that he has seen over time. He's saying that any of the skepticism that he's had is now being overrun by the data and the evidence. And he goes up there quite regularly. He's not somebody who's there all the time, but he goes back repeatedly to see what is going on. And he's written this book called The Brave New Arctic, The Untold Story of the Melting North. And it's really worth our time to listen to him today on America Trends. Mark Serez is with us, and his book is called Brave New Arctic, The Untold Story of the Melting North. And Mark, although I think on our podcast there are probably many people who really have bought into climate change, but there are still a lot of skeptics out there. And I know you as a scientist find that to be frustrating and disconcerting at this point in time. However, going back some time ago, you thought that perhaps there was another explanation other than man's contribution. Tell us how you turned the corner on this issue.
Yeah, well, the issue with me is that this was back in the late 1990s, and we were really seeing the Arctic change, no doubt about it. But I didn't see what I considered to be this fingerprint of a human impact on climate. What I saw were changes that seemed to be more easily explained from just what we call natural climate variability, shifts in wind patterns and things like this. And that's what I was seeing. And it took just a few more years, however, for me to turn around, because then, it was only over a span of about 5 years that human imprint of change became so prominent. So, yeah, I was a bit of a skeptic there for a while, but it was really just the vast weight of evidence that finally turned me over.
So for somebody who's listening who still may not have tipped the balance on this issue, I mean, is there one piece of evidence or information that attracted your attention as a scientist that you finally said, enough is enough, and I need to communicate this in books like Brave New Arctic?
Yeah, well, I would say it was really a compendium of all kinds of evidence. Okay, the sea ice cover is decreasing. Maybe you don't believe that. Maybe you don't believe those data. Then you got to explain why it's warming. Then you got to explain why the permafrost is warming, why the ocean is warming, all these sorts of things. And after a while, it gets pretty hard to refute that something big is going on. But I would say the thing that really turned me around, the one thing, was something that we call Arctic amplification. Now, this was something that was predicted quite some time ago, and this prediction was, as the climate begins to change, we're going to see the temperature increases in the Arctic first, and that's where they're going to be the most pronounced. And right around 2008, 2009, that just came out in force. And so what you've got is a situation now where the Arctic is warming up at least twice the rate as the rest of the globe. And that was one of these predictions that was out there a long time ago and turned out to be absolutely spot on. So that was certainly one of the big pieces for me.
And the Arctic, I mean, you have spent a lot of time there. Most of us have only seen it in pictures and video. Give us a snapshot of what the Arctic really is, what it means to you as somebody who has journeyed there so many times, and why it's a harbinger of what's to come around here.
Yeah, well, it's at least when I first went there, why I got hooked on it was just this pristine, unspoiled place. I started work up in this little ice cap on Ellesmere Island, way up north, 82 degrees north. I was then part of Northwest Territories. Now it's part of Nunavut. Just stepped out of this airplane and was just, wow, just floored by what I had seen. And that hooked me on it. It's a very sparse beauty, very spare beauty to it. It's a hard thing to describe, but yeah, a lot of things have really changed up there. And I didn't get to go up there this year, just the schedule didn't work, but hopefully that will be an exception rather than the rule.
You say that the climate records are clear. Surface temperatures are rising twice as fast compared to the rest of the globe. So twice as fast in the Arctic.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And this is this idea of this Arctic amplification. And the very early climate models we had coming out in the mid-1970s were saying that when things start warming up, this is what we're going to see. We're going to see this Arctic amplification. And that turned to be spot on, as I mentioned. Now, the reality is this thinking actually goes back a lot further than that. Way back in 1896, this very smart guy named Svante Arrhenius, who later won the Nobel Prize, basically said that as atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide rise, we're going to see the change most strongly in the polar regions. Now, he wasn't quite right, because it's really the Arctic as opposed to the Antarctic, but he pretty much hit the nail on the head. So it just goes to show you how long people have been thinking about these sorts of things.
And help us to understand the difference between the Arctic and the Antarctic. Probably many of us confuse the two.
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, the Antarctic is where the penguins are, of course. We don't have those in the Arctic. In the Arctic, we have polar bears and things like that. They are very different poles apart, as people say. And the Arctic is really responding very fast right now. It's strongly warming up. The Antarctic has been more of that sleeping elephant that's now beginning to stir. Oh, yeah, the Antarctic is warming up, but not like the Antarctic. I mean, not like the Arctic. And a lot of that is just plain old physical geography. If you look at the Arctic, it's a big Arctic Ocean surrounded by land. The Antarctic is a big, high, very cold ice sheet surrounded by ocean. Very, very different places, and they're behaving very differently.
You say that the scientific community is shaken, and you use that term, I'm sure, advisedly. How shaken are they, and how frustrated are they that we, who are just everyday citizens, may be getting disinformation about this?
Well, we are shocked. I think, it's a shock that's actually grown through the years. In many ways, we never thought that the changes would unfold as fast as they have. And I think to all of us, it's extremely frustrating because the Arctic really is telling that story. I've been on some radio interview or something where I said something like the Arctic is screaming, and it really is screaming. It's getting hoarse at this point. But we've long known that the Arctic is where this is going to happen first, where this is going to be the biggest, and that's exactly what is happening. And it really is that red flag out there, and it is very frustrating to us that it's hard to convey what is happening up there and what that potentially means for the rest of the world.
And how much should the scientific community be working to tell that story? Perhaps because you say the theme of your book is complexity, the implications for mankind, that you're having a hard time distilling this information for the layperson.
It can be a little hard to distill some of this for the layperson, but not as hard as you might think. There are a lot of avenues out there to really get that word out. At our center, National Snow and Ice Data Center, one of our biggest sites is what we call Arctic Sea Ice News and Analysis, where you can go in every day and see what the sea ice is doing, and we have periodic posts where we discuss what is happening to the sea ice. And last year, we had, I think, 5 million visits to that from all kinds of people. We're not just talking scientists. We're talking from politicians right down to a fifth grader wanting to do a science report or something like that. It is possible to get that word out there, and you don't have to dumb the science down to really convey what is happening. It's a bit of an art, I suppose, but I think it's a lot of us in the community who are getting better and better and better at that. Scientists now have a new obligation, and that is to communicate what is happening, and we're seeing a lot of people, a lot of scientists now starting to take up that challenge.
And your book, Brave New Arctic, what are you trying to do? I mean, you're talking about how science is done and how science and politics mix, because for somebody who's looking for a way, perhaps we have teachers listening in and others who want to communicate some of these concerns, what would your book provide them with?
Well, I think it provides them with first of all, certainly an understanding of what's happening to the Arctic. But as you say, I think it's a very important story about how science is actually done, how science is really very much like being a detective, running down leads, even playing hunches, looking for clues, and that also science is also a very, very human process. We're people just like everyone else. And I think there's some real important stories there to humanize the science and to tell people how we actually do science. This is a big mystery to a lot of people. You scientists, how do you actually do this? Well, that's one thing I try to relate is how it's done.
And the people who live, I don't know how sparsely populated the Arctic is, I would assume rather sparse, but they seem so, I'm sure, aware of the changes. It affects their life and livelihood. How much are they, you know, perhaps understanding this better than even the scientists?
Of course, they live there, so they're living with it. And there's a growing awareness of how much the people that live up there really know and how much they really can contribute to the science. There's a lot of work. I mean, just working in partnership with the residents of the North, in my case with people up in Alaska, they're very aware of it. For example, if you live up on the north coast of Alaska, big thing you're dealing with right now is coastal erosion. You've got places eroding back 30 feet per year. So if you're looking for people who are on the front lines of climate change, it is the peoples of the Arctic.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter, that's right, where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
You tell us that climate change is not a vague threat, and to many of us, that's the way we view it, that it's real and it's here. And for people who are still somewhat skeptical, provide us with some further illustrations.
Well, I would say that, first of all, going back to, I think, what I mentioned before, is that the Arctic is that red flag. We knew that that's the place where things would change first, and that's exactly what we were seeing. So it's kind of that canary in the coal mine. And we understand pretty well exactly why that is happening. But why, you know, when I say climate change is here and it's real, you know, I hate to say, go back and say, well, it's in the physics, but it is in the physics. We understand how greenhouse gases warm up the atmosphere and the surface quite well. This is something that's at the heart of any kind of atmospheric remote sensing, to microwave ovens, to everything else. You know, this is something we actually understand rather well.
So this whole idea that it's natural variability, that we've seen these cycles, and that it will reverse itself, unless we take some action, you're saying that is just not the case.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Now, there's always been natural variability in the climate system. There always will be. Natural variability, like shifts in like the big scale jet stream you've probably heard of, that bring different weather patterns. So out in Toronto, for example, out here where I'm at now, you have a run of winters go by where it's really cold and snowy, and then you have another run of winters go by where it's much warmer or maybe a lot of rain. That's the sort of natural variability that's always been with us and always will be with us. But that natural variability is superposed, laid upon this overall warming trend, and that overall warming trend is inescapable, and we know very well why it's there.
Let me take some of the quotes from your book, Brave New Arctic, The Untold Story of the Melting North, and just to amplify them a bit. The Arctic is quickly losing its summer sea ice cover, and wintertime losses are also starting to become prominent. Help us with that.
Yeah, well, one of probably the most visible change in the Arctic is what's happened to that sea ice cover. Now, of course, it's a floating ice cover on the Arctic Ocean. It ranges from half a centimeter thick up to 10 meters more thick, 30 feet in some places. And it waxes and wanes with the seasons. So naturally it grows through the autumn and the winter, and it shrinks through the spring and the summer. We've tended to be looking at the end of summer extent of the ice as this sort of indicator of the overall health of the sea ice cover. And it makes sense, because after all the autumn and winter growth has occurred, the spring and summer melt has happened, what have you got left? And that's what you have in like September. And it's going down like a rock, you know, something like 13% per decade. And there's ups and downs upon that, of course. But there used to be, until recently, no one was paying a whole lot of attention to what was happening in winter. The trends were smaller, but they were there, of course. But, boy, that's really starting to change. The last four winters, we've seen these tremendous heat waves over the Arctic Ocean, something I've never seen before. And that's certainly affecting the growth of ice in the winter, and it appears like the ocean's getting into the act now, bringing a lot of heat in from the south in ways that are preventing winter ice growth. So there's a lot of crazy things going on right now in winter. So, yeah, we've been tending to look at what happens in summer in the Arctic in terms of the sea ice, but winter has suddenly become very, very interesting.
You're listening to Mark Serez, and he is a renowned climatologist and director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center. What happened in 2007, Mark? You devote an entire chapter to that.
That's right. Well, most of a chapter. I think the chapter is called Rude Awakenings, and this really was a rude awakening. If we look back the year, a few years before 2007, now by then the loss of sea ice, especially in summer, was certainly quite pronounced, and everyone was quite aware of this and talking a lot about it in the science community. And then we had a record low September extent in 2005, which a lot of people were like, wow, that's, you know, we've never seen anything like that. And but then comes along the summer of 2007, and it didn't just beat that 2005 record, it just completely blew it away. And throughout that summer, there were thousands of scientists, I think, around the world looking at their computer screens as the new satellite data kept coming in, watching immense chunks of the ice just getting eaten away day after day after day. And we ended up with certainly the lowest sea ice on record, stands at second lowest right now, because it was beat by 2012. But it was just this jaw-dropper. And I think after that summer, any remaining shred of doubt that anyone had that the title of the book, A Brave New Arctic, was upon us, was gone at that point. Then there's still a few people saying, well, we'll never see an event like 2007 in, 50 years or something like that. And then along comes 2012. It blew away the 2007 record. So 2007 was really the first, I would say, of a series of rude awakenings in the Arctic that really, you know, woke us up to the fact that, wow, things are not going to be the same again.
What kind of laboratory is the Arctic? Are there many people like you up there all the time? And is this really the canary in the coal mine?
Yeah. Well, there's all kinds of scientists. Now, I'm not actually up there all the time. You know, I go up when I can. But most of my work I do back down at the University of Colorado, looking at things like the satellite data and things like that, you know, looking at things from orbit. So I'm kind of a guy that gets out there when I can. You know, you got to get hit it with your own hammer. But there are other people, people from the University of Fairbanks, for example, kind of makes sense, who are really pretty much up there all the time. And so we rely on each other because we rely on the folks that are there all the time to tell us what's going on the front lines, right? Mm. And on the other hand, they look to the people like us or others at our research center who can kind of put that bigger picture together, looking at things from space. So I get up there when I can, but it's not like I'm up there all the time. I do have to have a day job, you know.
Oh, I understand. But there are a lot of people all the time who are looking at this, and they are the canaries, I would imagine.
That's
in
right.
This coal mine.
And of course, then there's the residents of the Arctic themselves, right? And there, of course, they live up there.
Now, you write that looking forward, well within the century, the Arctic Ocean will be essentially free of its floating sea ice cover in late summer.
Yeah, that's right. It will. Now, it's a bit of a symbolic number in the sense that what we're asking is what's the year, what year is it going to be that you will go out to the Arctic and look, say from outer space, say from satellite, and there'll be no sea ice left, or very little sea ice, you know, maybe a smidgen left. And that's what we call a seasonally ice-free Arctic Ocean. Now, when would might that occur? Now, it's a bit of a symbolic thing, because even as we continue to lose the sea ice cover, the impacts of that sea ice loss are going to grow and grow and grow. But there is going to be this time where you're going to go out, and there's going to be no sea ice at all, or very little anyhow. And if you look at, there's a lot of uncertainty in just when that's going to occur. I think there's very little uncertainty that it is going to occur. It is. I think we're committed right now. But if you look at where a lot of scientists are looking now, they're looking at sometime in the 2040s for that to happen. Now, I've been on a little more of an aggressive tack on that. I've on record saying, say, 2030 might be around the year. And I'm going to stand behind that because one of the things we're seeing now is the Arctic's older, thicker ice is disappearing very, very, very fast right now. And I think that's the kicker. You lose that thick, old ice, then it's just a matter of time.
When we look at the Industrial Revolution and some of the pollutants we put into the air, and you look at where we are today, having gone from that point in the late 19th century, you say that we are now geoengineering our own planet. We've entered the Anthropocene. How drastic and powerful a statement is that from a scientist like you?
Well, I think it is it's a powerful statement. This is something that people have been talking about for some time, that we've moved into kind of a new geologic era now, that we're basically driving the bus. We're the ones in control. We have geoengineered our planet. We've actually been doing it for, I mean, a long, long time, even before the Industrial Revolution, for example, you know, deforestation, all sorts of things. So we've been... humankind has been altering our planet for a long, long time, but really starting, you know, late 19th or, well, Industrial Revolution and on beyond that, and then especially into the 20th and 21st century, things have really taken off. And I think in many ways we are in control of the future right now. We're the ones driving the bus.
Okay, so what do we do? I mean, and how frustrated are you about the political inaction, the U.S. getting out of the climate accord?
There's a lot of. I mean, that's a sad thing. Now, I'm very pragmatic about these things, and I think you have to be pragmatic about these things. That look, we built an entire society out of the immense amount of energy in cheap fossil fuels, the amount of energy in a lump of coal or a barrel of gasoline, and basically every modern convenience we have is based on that, from your oven to your windows to anything plastic to, of course, driving, you know, automobiles, things like that. And unless you're willing to get around on a, you know, horse and buggy made of native materials tied together by hemp rope or something like that, you know, you're complicit. We're all complicit in this. And so what I think we need to do is just get rid of this blame game and accept the reality of where we are and take pragmatic steps forward. And, of course, the first part of doing that is to actually admit that we have a problem here, okay, and work together on it. And that's where the frustration lies, in that the physics behind what's happening is rock solid, yet there are still vested interests that do not want to see the reality for which it is. And unfortunately, that would include certainly the U.S. government.
Do you think the fact that a politician really was the first spokesman for this concern, I'm talking about Al Gore, as opposed to a scientist, I mean, had it been someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson or someone else, would that have helped?
It may have helped. Certainly Al Gore has been helpful in this regard. I think in some ways he's hurt himself a bit as well, because he tends to kind of over-sensationalize at times, and that's not really a helpful thing either. In other words, there's plenty of shrill on both sides of this argument, and that's not going to help us. So who do we have for that spokesman? I mean, it would be nice if our Donald Trump might come out and say, we've got a problem here and let's work on it. I don't see that sort of thing happening. But where are those strong voices? I think that's a very good question. Where are those strong voices? And I think some of it has to come from the scientists. But, of course, we need to also, if we're going to do that, we need to speak with a much louder voice.
And do you think that's beginning to happen? And will it continue as you see these signs that are warning signs that are dramatic and danger ahead? Will you get a little more shrill, the scientific community?
I think it's good to be shrill. You can be shrill, but let's not be shrill in an unproductive way.
Mm.
Some of the talk out there that, well, we're all doomed, right? Well, that's not helpful, and that's not true either, because we are a remarkably adaptable species. I think we have to stick with the science, but we have to speak with a unified voice. And you are seeing the science community start to come to the fore. I think there's a big change now in how science is done and the young people being brought up as scientists. There's this understanding now that you can't just be sitting in your office or your ivory tower doing your thing. That science communication is a big part of that. That's something that I really instill to my students, for example. So I think the field or the world is changing in that way. But I would say also, having said that, in terms of the science community, we're just starting to find our voice, I think. Just starting.
Mark Serres, I want to thank you so much. The book is called Brave New Arctic, The Untold Story of the Melting North. And you mentioned how at your center, if people would like to follow what's going on a daily basis, how can they do that? What would you suggest for somebody who's really fascinated with the topic?
Yeah, well, all you need to do is Google on NSIDC, NSIDC. That stands for the National Snow and Ice Data Center, and it'll take you right there. And we have all kinds of resources, but you'll see a piece on that says Arctic Sea Ice News and Analysis. Just click on that, and once you do that, you can track it every day, see what's going on, the blow-by-blow account of what's happening to the sea ice.
All right, Mark Serres, again, a pleasure to have you with us on America Trends.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.